Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
This episode is brought to you by Polestar. There's only one true way to experience the all-electric luxury SUV Polestar 3, and that's to take a test drive. It can go from 0 to 60 in as little as 4.8 seconds with the dynamic handling of a sports car. But to truly understand how it commands the road, you need to be behind the wheel. Up to 350 miles of range, the 3D surround sound system by Bowers & Wilkins, it's all something you have to experience to believe. So book your test drive for Polestar 3 today at Polestar.com.
When life brings the blah, add more Yabba Dabba Doo with some tasty fruity pebbles. Early morning meeting, blah. Someone brought the pebbles? Yabba Dabba Doo. Run errands, blah. Head to the store for pebbles. Yabba Dabba Doo. Fruity Pebbles, less blah, more Yabba Dabba Doo. Pick up Pebbles cereal today. Yabba Dabba Doo and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly.
And I am your co-host, Austin.
And today we are diving into part two of the O.J. Simpson case, the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. But before we dive into the specifics of the O.J. Simpson trial, there is a part one. So if you have not listened to that, go listen to that. That details everything that happened on that fateful night. And now we're going to get into the trial and what went wrong.
And we just got done talking about the Bronco chase.
Yes. Yep. That's where we left off. So before we delve into the specifics, it's crucial to understand the socio-political climate of LA during the early 90s. Now, this backdrop played a significant role in shaping public perception and potentially the outcome of the trial. So on the night of March 3rd, 1991, Rodney King, an African-American man, was driving with two passengers through LA. Rodney was on parole for robbery and had been drinking, leading him to fear returning to prison if he was caught driving under the influence. So when California Highway Patrol officers Tim and Melanie Singer noticed Rodney speeding, they attempted to pull him over. Rodney then led them on a high-speed chase, reaching speeds of up to 110 miles per hour. The chase ended when he exited the freeway and pulled over in a residential neighborhood. By this time, several LAPD units had joined the pursuit, and among the officers were Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, Theodore Braceno, and Stacy Kuhn, who took charge of the situation. What happened next would become a critical moment in American history. After exiting his vehicle, Rodney King was ordered to lie face down on the ground, and initially he complied, but then he allegedly resisted by trying to get up. So the officers, perceiving this as a threat, proceeded to beat him mercilessly. Sergeant Kuhn later testified that he attempted to restrain Rodney with a taser twice, which seemed ineffective, and the situation quickly escalated, leading to a brutal beating. But what the police may not have realized at the time was that the entire altercation was captured on video by George Holliday, who was a resident of a nearby apartment complex. The footage, which lasts about 9 minutes, shows Rodney being struck more than 50 times with police batons. He was kicked in the head and shocked with a taser. Now, the footage sparked widespread outrage when it was broadcast nationwide. The officers involved were charged, but their acquittal in April of 92 triggered the infamous LA riots. For 6 days, the city was engulfed in violence, resulting in over 60 deaths, thousands of injuries, nearly 12,000 arrests, and extensive property damage with estimated losses exceeding $1 billion.
Holy smokes.
In 93, two of the officers, Lawrence Powell and Stacy Kuhn, were found guilty in a federal trial for violating Rodney's civil rights and were sentenced to 30 months in prison. In 1994, Rodney King was awarded $3.8 million in a civil lawsuit against the city of LA. Now, the Rodney King incident and the subsequent riots exposed deep-seated racial tensions and distrust in the LAPD, particularly among the African-American community. This atmosphere of racial tension and skepticism toward law enforcement was still palpable when O.J. Simpson, a beloved African-American sports hero, was accused of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. And the parallels between the two cases were not lost on the public or the legal teams involved in O.J.'s trial. So O.J.'s defense team, famously dubbed as the Dream Team, consisted of high-profile attorneys with a reputation for winning difficult cases. The key members included Robert Shapiro, who initially took the lead role in O.J.'s defense, and he was known for his negotiation skills. And Shapiro's strategy really focused on pre-trial publicity and media management. Next, he had Johnny Cochran, who later emerged as the lead attorney. And Johnny Cochran was a charismatic lawyer with a history of defending African Americans against police brutality. His involvement brought a racial dimension to the defense strategy. Then you have F. Lee Bailey, a seasoned attorney known for his aggressive courtroom tactics and cross-examination skills. Alan Dershowitz, who was a Harvard law professor with a background in constitutional law and a knack for appellate work. And then you have Barry Scheck and Peter Newfield, who were experts in DNA evidence, who challenged the prosecution's forensic evidence. The prosecution team was led by Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden, both experienced and determined to secure a conviction. Now, Marsha Clark, who was the lead prosecutor known for her meticulous preparation and strong courtroom presence, faced significant media scrutiny and gender bias throughout the entire trial. Additionally, her personal life was also dragged into the spotlight. As a single mother going through a divorce during the trial, she faced public questioning of her ability to balance her demanding job with her responsibilities as a mother. And this line of questioning, which is rarely directed at male professionals, suggested that her personal life might impede her effectiveness as a prosecutor, which is just really unfair. And then Christopher Darden was brought on to co-prosecute, and Christopher Darden aimed to bridge the racial gap in the jury because he was African-American. His decision to have Simpson try on the infamous glove was a pivotal moment in the trial, and I think that's like the one thing you seem to know about this trial.
Yeah, if the glove fits, you must acquit.
If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah, whatever it is, I knew that part.
Yeah, you know it well. So Judge Lance Ito presided over the trial, and his handling of the case, particularly his management of the media and high-profile attorneys, was often criticized because Ito allowed extensive media coverage, which turned the trial into a complete circus and a spectacle and arguably influenced the proceedings. So we kind of saw that with the Menendez brothers, because the first trial was highly publicized. And then the second trial, the judge said, you can't include any testimony about the sexual abuse or any kind of abuse. And you also, it also wasn't going to be televised.
Which completely skews the whole thing.
Right. But that just kind of, like, this happened around the same time. So it's just interesting to see the effects that these things have on court proceedings. Mm-hmm. So DNA evidence played a very central role in the prosecution's case. Blood samples collected from the crime scene, Simpson's home, and his Bronco matched O.J. Simpson's DNA. And this should have been damning evidence, but several factors undermined its impact. So number one was the collection and handling of that evidence. The defense highlighted potential contamination and mishandling of evidence by LAPD. For example, criminologist Dennis Fung admitted under cross-examination that standard procedures were not always followed, which obviously casts some doubt. The defense also cast doubt on the integrity of the evidence by questioning the chain of custody. They suggested that the evidence could have been tampered with or planted by racist police officers, specifically Mark Furman, who was later found to have frequently and comfortably used racial slurs, and he was recorded saying the N-word multiple times. But the defense also brought in expert testimony with Barry Scheck and Peter Newfield as they effectively cross-examined the prosecution's DNA experts, raising doubts about the reliability of the forensic evidence presented. Now, several key factors contributed to the prosecution's failure to secure a conviction. First, there was the glove incident, which is perhaps the most infamous moment of the trial, which was when Darden asked O.J. Simpson to try on the glove that was found at the crime scene. O.J. Simpson struggled to put it on, leading Cochran to famously quip, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit."
Now, so it didn't fit him.
Correct.
But it was just like tight. I mean, yeah, obviously it did fit him, you know?
Yeah.
Right. But like, we didn't.
Right. Yeah. You basically summed it up.
So he got his hand in it. It was just kind of a tight fit.
Yeah. I mean, it looked like when you look at the footage of him trying it on, it's almost like trying to put a glove on a two-year-old. Like, you're just making it hard. I mean, you probably could have gotten it over your hands, but even if it didn't completely fit, your blood was still on it. Nicole and Ron's blood was on it. Like,
I've put on gloves that are too small before, and they make your hands look real stubby, and they fit.
Yeah.
They just don't, you know?
Yeah, they fit, but they just don't fit.
Yeah.
But this moment really undermined the prosecution's case and created reasonable doubt about the glove. And then also there were racial tensions, as the defense cleverly played on existing racial tensions, portraying OJ as a victim of a racist LAPD. Cochran's closing arguments compared Furman to Adolf Hitler and invoked the Rodney King incident, resonating deeply with the predominantly African-American jury. And then the trial's extensive media coverage, like I said, turned it into a spectacle, influencing public perception and potentially the jury. The defense used the media to their advantage while the prosecution struggled with the constant scrutiny. The media used the trial as a sensational news story, often covering drama and not reporting actual facts. This coverage influenced public opinion and may have even affected the jury. And I also have to wonder if the extreme presence of the media and public interest created pressure on the jury, who knew that they would be scrutinized regardless of the decision they made. So maybe they felt compelled to deliver a verdict that would resonate with the public rather than one based solely on the evidence. And this is not an assumption that I would normally make, because I believe that more often than not, jurors do get it right. But considering that this verdict seemed so wrong, this is just my attempt, I guess, at giving grace to the jurors who decided OJ's ultimate fate. Now, on October 3rd of 1995, the jury delivered a verdict of not guilty on the charges of murder for Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. Many African Americans celebrated the verdict, viewing it as a victory against a historically racist justice system. But conversely, many white Americans were outraged, believing that a guilty man had been set free due to his celebrity status and the failings of the legal system. Now, the verdict highlighted the deep racial divide in America and sparked widespread debate about the justice system, police practices, and media influence on high-profile cases. The trial's aftermath saw ongoing discussions about race, celebrity, and the law, with the case remaining a point of reference in American culture and legal history. The trial of O.J. Simpson was more than just a legal battle. It was a cultural phenomenon that exposed the complexities of race, celebrity, and justice in America. And the case's outcome, shaped by the context of the Rodney King riots, the strategies of the Dream Team, and the handling of the DNA evidence, continues to resonate even today. The extensive media coverage was unprecedented, and since this trial, it's become normal for high-profile cases to receive extensive coverage in the media. We've seen it with Casey Anthony. I mean, even now, like Law and Crime or Court TV, they will just stream trials. Mm-hmm. I mean, like day after day, it's just live streaming these trials. Johnny Depp and Amber Heard is another example. Just
here recently, the couple that was in the hiking couple, Laundrie.
Oh, Brian Laundrie and Gabby Petito.
Gabby Petito, that's what I was trying to say.
Well, that wasn't so much as, like, there was no trial because he ended up killing himself.
I'm just saying the media was heavy.
Right, yeah. Exactly, yes. And we're seeing it with the Koberger and the Idaho 4 students, and the Delphi trial is starting this week. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon now for access to these trials to just be super easy to come by, which actually, now that I say that, I don't believe that the Delphi trial is going to be broadcast because judges still have the option to allow those to be televised. And I don't think the Delphi one is going to be televised, but you can still access court records and things like that. It's become a lot easier to access all this information with like the internet and the Freedom of Information Act. It's just interesting. I feel like with the rise of true crime and the interest in it, like we're just seeing more interest in crime now than we ever have. And I think OJ and that trial really kind of set things into motion. Mm-hmm. Now, OJ's trial lasted for about 11 months. Can you imagine that? 11 months.
And he's out the whole time or he's in jail?
I'm not sure actually if he was in jail that whole time or if he was out on any kind of bond. That's a good question. Maybe you can look it up while I talk about this. But the jury, like I've served on a jury for a week and a half, and that felt like a long time. 11 months, day after day, you've got to leave your job behind. Like you cannot miss a day of court, regardless of how you feel or what your kids are doing or whatever. Like there are no sick days.
After being arrested in June of 94, he pled not guilty. And in July of 1994, he was released on $1 million bail. Okay. He remained free throughout the majority of the trial, which lasted from January to October 95.
Wow. Yeah.
Crazy.
So the Simpson trial also became a cultural touchstone reflecting broader societal issues such as domestic violence and celebrity worship and the power of the media. But it also prompted major reforms in the legal and forensic science communities. So the mishandling of the evidence by the LAPD led to a widespread criticism. And in response, many police departments across the country implemented stricter protocols and more extensive training. While DNA evidence played a central role in the O.J. Simpson trial, the way it was handled led to doubts about DNA's reliability. The trial highlighted the need for better education of jurors and the public about the science behind DNA evidence. And as a result, subsequent trials have seen more rigorous standards for presenting and explaining DNA evidence, with efforts to ensure that jurors fully understand its significance and its limitations. The trial also influenced how lawyers approach jury selection and trial strategy, particularly in these high-profile cases. The defense team's use of race as a central theme in their strategy set a precedent for how attorneys might use social and psychological factors to sway juries. And this has led to a greater emphasis on the understanding of the composition of the jury and tailoring arguments to resonate with their specific backgrounds and experiences. And the extensive media coverage of the Simpson trial also prompted discussions about the role of the media in the legal process. The trial showed how media coverage could influence public opinion and potentially impact the proceedings themselves. So in response, some legal experts called for stricter guidelines on media access to trials, while others argued for better public education on legal processes to mitigate the effects of sensationalism. So I think that's interesting because
obviously I watch a lot of trials to just gather information about these cases that we cover on the podcast. But if you're just watching because you find it interesting, then it's important to be watching this with the mindset of how these things work rather than just believing everything that the media tells you. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If you have a better understanding of how these things work, then I think you're better suited to watch these trials.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Question.
Yeah.
This is a late response.
Okay.
The jury duty for 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
What do is it every day?
Yeah. Every day that the trial is going. I mean, they might have days off.
But are they sequestered?
Not always. It really just depends on the case.
And are you getting paid?
Yes, you do get paid, but it's like pennies. But a lot of jobs, and I don't know if this was the law then, but a lot of jobs protect your job and your income if you have jury duty. Like, they still have to pay you even though you're not there, but it's because you're serving.
Can you imagine jury months? Duty. That would be crazy.
No, I cannot imagine. 11 months.
You'd be like, oh, this is so fun. I'd be like, you're a lunatic. Make it stop.
You're kind of right. I do get excited over jury duty. I'm still waiting on my next summons.
Yeah.
Anyway, following OJ's acquittal, his life was marked by a series of legal and personal troubles that kept him in the public eye, albeit in a much different light than during his days as a beloved sports figure. But although OJ was acquitted in the criminal trial, the families of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman filed a civil lawsuit against him. And in 1997, a civil court found Simpson liable for the wrongful deaths of Nicole and Ron, and he was ordered to pay $33.5 million in damages to their families.
What does that mean? He was found liable.
So you can be found liable of a wrongful death, but not be guilty of their murders.
Is that implying he had something to do with it?
Yeah, it's basically a court saying we do believe that he is liable for their deaths, even though this initial trial got it wrong.
But we're not going to charge you with a first or second or third degree murder?
Yeah, they're separate. They're two different trials, and it's not a double jeopardy situation. It's a wrongful death suit. It's like a civil suit rather than a criminal case.
What?
I know. It's complicated.
So did he pay it?
No. The civil judgment financially devastated O.J. Simpson, as much of his wealth was already depleted by legal fees, and he struggled to meet those financial obligations to the families. So I don't know how much he paid to them over time, but I know that he did not meet the $33.5 million that he was ordered to pay. And the civil judgment, coupled with his criminal trial acquittal, significantly tarnished that public image. He was once revered as this athlete and celebrity, and then he became a pariah in many circles. He faced social isolation, with many of his former friends and associates distancing themselves from him. And despite his acquittal, a significant portion of the public continued to believe in his guilt, and he was often subject to public scorn and ridicule, which honestly, I kind of love to see it, because like with Casey Anthony being acquitted in the murder of her daughter, I still feel like her life outside of prison might be worse than it would have been in. I mean, I don't know, because she's kind of a sociopath and she's just like living it up and going to bars and has a boyfriend apparently now. And so I don't know, but I still have to wonder if these people who were acquitted, but the vast majority of the public believes in their guilt, fear every time they go out into public. Like, are they always looking over their shoulder? Because everyone knows who you are at this point, and they all believe in your guilt. So wouldn't that, like, you would think it would eat away at somebody, but these people are probably sociopaths, so right. Maybe it doesn't.
They're lunatics.
Mm-hmm.
I Googled it just because I'm curious. O.J. Simpson paid approximately less than 1% of the total amount of the suit due to a combination of legal strategies, including the protection of his NFL pension, which is exempt from being seized to satisfy the judgment.
Wow, that's bullshit. So O.J.'s
O.J. doesn't agree with you.
Mm-hmm. He can come fight me.
He's dead.
OJ's post-trial life was also marred by further legal troubles. In 2007, he was arrested in Las Vegas
this
for his involvement
crazy.
In a robbery at a hotel casino. So tell me what you know about this.
I just know armed robbery, and he served like a decade in prison. And it doesn't look very good whenever you are the guy that was supposedly didn't kill her and him.
Yeah, well, yeah, he claimed that he was attempting to retrieve personal memorabilia that had been stolen from him. But the court found him guilty of multiple charges, including armed robbery and kidnapping. And in 2008, he was sentenced to 33 years in prison with eligibility for parole after 9 years. So this conviction was seen by many as a form of karmic justice, a way for society to hold him accountable after his acquittal. I mean, at least he's being held accountable for something. But Simpson was granted parole and released in October of 2017. However, his reputation remained permanently damaged. Now, more importantly, most importantly, let's discuss the impact on the victims' families. Both families have become advocates for victims' rights and domestic violence awareness in the wake of the trial. The Brown and Goldman families worked tirelessly to keep the memory of Nicole and Ron alive, while also using their platforms to speak out about the injustices they perceived in the legal system. Their advocacy has contributed to greater awareness of domestic violence issues and the need for legal reforms to better protect victims. The civil suit against Simpson offered some measure of vindication after the miscarriage of justice they received during the criminal trial, but the civil court's finding of OJ's liability and the substantial financial judgment against him served as a form of, I think, weak accountability. But the financial aspects of the judgment were largely symbolic, as OJ didn't fulfill his financial obligations anyway. Now, the Brown family, particularly Nicole Brown Simpson's sister, Denise Brown, has become deeply involved in advocacy work related to domestic violence. Denise Brown emerged as a strong voice against domestic violence in the wake of her sister's murder. She founded the Nicole Brown Foundation, an organization dedicated to educating the public about domestic violence and how to support victims. And through this work, she has traveled the country speaking about the warning signs of abuse, the importance of early intervention, and the need for stronger legal protections for victims. And she has inspired legislative changes aimed at better protecting victims as well. The Brown family has focused on keeping Nicole's memory alive through their advocacy efforts and also their personal endeavors. They have worked to ensure that Nicole is remembered not just as a victim, but as a loving mother and daughter and sister. The family has participated in various memorials and events in Nicole's honor, continually reminding the public of the person that she was before her life was cut short. And this focus on preserving her legacy has been a way for the Brown family to channel their grief into a positive action. While the Brown family has remained active in their advocacy work, they also had to find ways to heal personally. The trauma of losing Nicole so violently and so publicly has been a constant presence in their lives. Over the years, the family has sought to maintain a sense of normalcy and privacy amidst the ongoing public interest in Nicole's story, and they have faced the challenges of grieving in the public eye, but they have also found strength in their commitment to making a difference through their advocacy. Now, the Goldman family, led by Ron's father, Fred, and his sister, Kim Goldman, has been relentless in their pursuit of justice for Ron. Their journey has been marked by both public and private battles as they continue to fight for their son and brother's memory. Fred Goldman's quest for justice became a symbol of perseverance in the fight for justice following the acquittal of OJ. Unwilling to accept the criminal trial's outcome, Fred pursued a civil lawsuit against Simpson, which is what resulted in that $33.5 million judgment in 97. And although the financial compensation was largely symbolic, as Simpson was obviously unable to pay it, the civil case provided a little bit of accountability that the criminal trial did not. And Fred's determination to hold OJ responsible, even through financial means, has been a testament to his unwavering love for his son. His sister Kim has also become an advocate for victims' rights, using her platform to speak out on issues related to the legal system, victim advocacy, and her brother's memory. She authored a book, Can't Forgive, My 20-Year Battle with O.J. Simpson, in which she explores her ongoing struggle with the emotional aftermath of the trial and her efforts to find peace. Kim has also worked with various organizations to support victims of violent crime, using her personal experience to help others navigate their own journeys through grief and justice. The Goldman family has had to balance their public advocacy with their private lives. Both Kim and Fred Goldman have remained active in speaking out about their experiences, but they have also sought to protect their personal lives from the relentless media attention that has followed them for decades. The pain of losing Ron never fully subsides, but the Goldmans have found a way to channel their grief into purposeful action, keeping Ron's memory alive through their work. I really can't imagine trying to balance that.
Trying to balance grief and missing someone you love with media, that would be crazy.
Yeah, and trying to help other people, but also trying to keep some semblance of normalcy and privacy.
And your case is so well known that everyone that you ever talk to goes, oh my God, really? Mm-hmm. Like they all think they know everything about it. Mm-hmm. That'd just be weird. Mm-hmm. Same thing for Nicole's family.
Yeah. And trust me, the irony is not lost on me that here we are talking about this case on a true crime podcast where we talk about these stories on a daily basis mm-hmm. or a weekly basis, I guess. But yeah, I do think it's important to highlight the victims and the advocacy work that their families do after the fact, which is why I'm really trying to heavily talk about not so much the nitty-gritty of the trial, but more so just what has happened as a result of the trial, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. But despite the passage of time, both the Brown and Goldman's families continue to face challenges related to the enduring public interest in the O.J. Simpson case. And the trial remains a focal point in discussions about race, justice, and media influence, often bringing the families back into the spotlight. The families have had to contend with the ongoing media fascination with the Simpson case, particularly during key anniversaries, new developments, or when Simpson himself makes the headlines. And this has sometimes reopened old wounds as the families are reminded of the painful events that took their loved ones. Despite this, both families have learned to navigate the media landscape, using it as a platform to advocate for their causes while also setting boundaries to protect their privacy. Now, OJ's later legal troubles, including that 2007 arrest and subsequent imprisonment for robbery, have kept his name in the news, which in turn has often brought renewed attention to the original case. And for the Brown and Goldman families, these events have been a reminder of the ongoing complexities of their lives in the public eye. While some have seen Simpson's imprisonment for robbery as a form of belated justice, the families have continued to focus on their advocacy work rather than dwelling on OJ's fate. Which, speaking of his fate, in May of 2023, OJ reported that he had been diagnosed with cancer and expressed confidence that he would beat it. It was reported that he was suffering from prostate cancer and that he had started chemotherapy. And in his last Twitter video on February 11th, he said that while he was dealing with some issues, he was still in good health. However, a week and a half before his ultimate death, he canceled a scheduled memorabilia signing because he was not feeling well. At this time, he was living in Las Vegas next to the Rhodes Ranch Golf Club. And on April 10th of 2024, at the age of 76, he died. News of his death was met with mixed reactions. Neither the Bills or the 49ers or the University of Southern California published any kind of condolences or tributes following his death. The Pro Football Hall of Fame published a news release and lowered its flag to half staff to honor, I guess, his death. And the Heisman Trophy published a tribute to Simpson on Twitter and offered condolences to his family. But a lot of people did not care.
Yeah, I wonder, like, this may sound silly, but, like, surely he had at least a few family members he was close with and that loved him, right?
I'm sure. Like, his children probably. Yeah. I mean, I don't know the details of his relationship with his kids, so I cannot speak on that because I really don't know if they were close when he died, if they believe in his innocence, or if they believe in his guilt. I don't know. And so I don't want to speak on that because I truly don't know.
What is your confidence level that OJ did it?
100%.
What is your confidence level that Casey Anthony did it?
100%.
Which case blows your mind more or pisses you off more?
Casey Anthony.
Which person would you rather have lunch with?
I'd rather stick my hand in a blender than have a lunch with any of them.
Mama, mystery, out.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.